on the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur, because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. I hope you're having a great day out there riding the roller coaster life of being an entrepreneur. All we are doing here is to try to provide you the motivation to grow or to get started and to give you the tips and tricks and techniques to be a successful entrepreneur. There are so many ways that you can do this easier. People have found out the bad things and can educate you on all of the things to avoid, all of the things to double down on. And we're just trying to get you through the game and make you a winner. We have an absolutely fantastic show today. First up, we have Carla Andrzejczyk. She is amazing. The energy that she has and the enthusiasm, it is just unbelievable. She has worked with stars like Barbara Streisand and Cher and things like that. We will get her to tell us some of those stories. But the main thing we're going to talk about is her new book called No Try. We're not going to try to do anything. Try is a bad word with Carla, and she defends that thesis very, very well. And then from Australia, we have Daniel Murray to talk about his belief that empathy is the key. He is known as Mr. Empathy, and he has a book out called The Empathy Gap. We're going to talk about that. It's a fascinating conversation based on, you know, leadership and emotions and all of the things that come together when we talk about empathy. I don't think most people know the difference between empathy and sympathy. So we will talk about little basic stuff like that. Anyway, great show and appreciate you being with us. We are also on Billionaire Alert. You know what that means? We have a billionaire coming up in the next week, day, whatever. We're not going to tell you. It's just coming up soon. You don't want to miss it. Thanks for being with us. Oh, you got to go buy the book. The commercial here is going to tell you all about it, but you've got to go buy my book. Please, we need the support.
On climate change? Introducing The Real Environmentalists, the bold new book by Jim Beach. It's not about activists, politicians, or professors. It's about the entrepreneurs, real risk takers, building cleaner, smarter solutions, not for applause, but for profit. The entrepreneurs in the book aren't giving speeches. They're in labs, factories, and offices, cleaning the past and building clean products for the future. The Real Environmentalists is available now because the people saving the planet aren't the ones you think. Go to Amazon and search for Real Environmentalist. Thank you.
We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. Very excited to introduce another great guest. Please welcome Carla Andrzejczyk to the show. She is an author and has just released a new book called Stop Trying, The Life-Transforming Power of Trying Less and Doing More. It is available on that Amazon place. She had an amazing career prior to this in the music space. She was the vice president of creative writing development for EMI. And of course, EMI is the biggest music publisher out there. She worked with people like Barbara Streisand, Cher, Huey Lewis, Martha McBride, Earth, Wind & Fire, Mariah Carey, and Christina Aguilera. Very impressive. Carla, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm so great today, especially. Yeah.
Because you're not trying today?
I'm not trying today. And my book was released officially yesterday. And I'm already number one on Amazon's personal transformation new releases. So that's kind of really exciting.
Yes. Congratulations. Very impressive.
You.
So... tell us about the book, Stop Trying. That's a pretty bold title. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it really is. So I have always been triggered by the word try. And I have been fascinated with self-help books and, you know, people that go from zero to 60 and how, you know, just success stories fascinate me. And what I realized was It's the words we use. It's how I've lived my life from a young girl to now. And the words we use tell our brains how we're going to act, what we're going to do. And that try word has just triggered me. When I hear it, I just hear failure. I hear somebody unintentionally setting themselves up to not succeed. So when I say stop trying, it's basically stop building in the intention and the potential for failure before you even start. Change that word with I'm going to do this, and you're going to trigger a series of events that literally happen in your brain to more doing, and you'll have a better chance, not guaranteed, but a better chance at success when you do instead of try.
All right. What if I say I'm going to go do 30 pull-ups? And I'm going to go do it, but then I go try and I can only do two.
Okay. So if you say I'm going to try to do 30 pull-ups, you know,
no, I'm going to, Carla. I'm going to.
Okay. You're going to do 30 pull-ups. So what's happening is you're going to do as many as you can, but more than if you said you would try to. So the try to guy would be, all right, I'm going to try to do 30 pull-ups. So, you know, maybe you'll eke out three. But when you say I'm going to do 30 pull-ups, you're going to eke out maybe four or five more because your mental mindset is stronger. Your brain is fired up. You have more adrenaline, more serotonin, more all the good dopamine. That's what happens when you say do. But you have to be realistic. I can't say I'm going to play for the LA Kings. My husband would love it if I would. He's like the biggest hockey King fan in the planet, but it's not realistic. So you have to set realistic goals, of course. I listened to your interview with Lewis House, you know, and he talks about, you know, all of that stuff. And it all applies to this as well. You have to have very realistic goals that are motivated from a really good rooted place of motivation. But yeah, it will change your actions, believe it or not. It'll give you a boost when you say, I'm going to do.
Okay. Does it change anything chemically in the brain or?
It does.
Tell me about that. I love chemicals in the brain.
Yeah, right. All that neuroscience. Okay. So if you can actually Google a picture of your brain when you say, I'm going to try to do this. And it's lit up at a very low level. It's a low hum. It's kind of in neutral. You know, it's this place where you're waiting. Your brain is like waiting for a specific direction. So it's lit up literally on the screen, very low. And then the picture of I'm doing this and it's fired. That's when I said the adrenaline, serotonin, the dopamine, all that stuff kicks in and you are primed now to an action. The trying is a mental activity, but the doing is like, okay, now I have to do something. I have to have a physical action to back up my words and your brain is ready. So it's definitely physically different in your brain.
All right. In the book, you go through trying in a lot of detail. You talk about it as a generational thing and it's in our heads and all of that. Can you walk us through some of those chapters and give us the history of this try failure connection?
Absolutely. So the book is in four parts. It's a very quick, easy book to read. And it starts with, what does it mean to try? So what do we think it means? What does it really mean? And then secondly, why we do it? And then how is it bad for us? And how do you move forward into the world without using it? And so in the beginning, it's what does it mean to try? Well, we think it means we're doing. When we, you know, and I'm not talking about semantics. I'm not talking about I'm going to pick up my coffee cup and take a sip. Okay, that's a small action that you can just do. I'm talking about the big ticket items in life where we walk around and say, here's where the what we think it means. I'll try to call you back. I'm going to try to schedule a meeting. I'm trying to lose weight, trying to work on my relationship, trying to spend more time with my kids, trying to read more books. All that stuff is just talking about it and usually doesn't happen. You don't move past the I'm trying to part.
Maybe that's the intent, Carla. In Japanese, they have a way of saying yes that really means no, but they say yes. And yeah. Maybe, you know, like you ask your boss, can I get a raise? And he'll say that fake yes. And, you know, the answer is no. Maybe it's the same thing linguistically.
Well, all the intent you have, I can be very intent on running a marathon, but unless I do the action, it's not going to happen. But I can walk around saying to you, I'm going to try to run a marathon. I'm trying to train. Unless you do something, you're fooling yourself. So what we think it means is we think we're doing, but what it really means, Jim, is I'll kind of maybe sort of do it if-ish I feel like it. And I'm going to put it in that I'm trying to pile. But sometimes, you know, it's really sad. The reason I wrote the book is because, you know, why we do it is we're taught to try. That's the generational heirloom. We're taught to try our best, try harder, give it a try, just try it. All those things you can come up with, right, as a kid. But that's very different from, you know what, do your best. Now you're arming your kid with, okay, I'm going to do what I have to do my best. And if I fail, I'm walking away with so much self-esteem because I actually studied longer than I would have if I said I'm going to try to study. I'm really going to do this, right? So it's a generational heirloom. We do it. We say we're going to try because we're so afraid of failure. Like, okay, I'll give this a try, which basically means I'm not sure it's going to happen. So you kind of dip your toe in the water. That's what, like, okay, I'll try it. I'll dip my toe in the water. And if it doesn't feel good, it's not for me. But if you say I'm doing this, you're jumping into the deep end and you're going to do everything to see if it works or not. I can't stress enough how when I hear somebody say they're going to try to do something, I know that they're not going to they're not going to go all in and they're going to half-heart it and they're probably going to give up too soon. That's what trying really means. And we miss our dreams. We end up having regret. We end up, you know, with a life that we could have had that because we only try and give up so easily and our health suffers. You know, think about the person that says, okay, I'm going to try to schedule that annual dermatology appointment. That's so important. And we just, okay, I'm going to try to find a doctor. I'm going to try to figure out the best time, try to find the right month or whatever. If you don't make that appointment, if you keep trying to make that appointment, you can end up missing a diagnosis that could save your life, right? There's some places where we can't try.
I don't understand how skin cancer kills you. If it's just cancer and it's on the outside of your body, why is that bad? I don't get it. I have to go tomorrow and have a thing taken off my huge forehead. They've already told me it's cancerous and it has to come out. And
good.
So that's tomorrow morning and I'm not looking forward to it. But I just don't get it. How can skin cancer be bad for you? It's on the outside of your body, isn't it? I just don't get it.
I know. I feel the same way. I'm a swimmer. I'm outside all the time. I know. I'm always surprised when I hear someone had a melanoma. But I'm really glad that you're getting it out of your body and that you made the appointment and you didn't try. You did it. You're doing it.
What is a try baby?
Oh my gosh. Okay. A try baby, you probably know one, you know, some of us are them. It's someone that just constantly complains about, I don't make enough money. I'm not getting promoted. I want a new car. I can't lose weight. I'm trying so hard and nothing's happening for me. That's a try baby. They're the people that instead of going out and going on LinkedIn, putting resumes in mailbox, visiting companies where they'd rather work, they're just complaining about it. They're trying at breakneck speed. They're just the complainers of people that are trying but not doing what they want.
Okay.
And can I want to just ask you a quick question, just to really like solidify this in your brain. We already know the difference between trying and doing and that we don't want to try sometimes. So would you go to the dermatologist tomorrow that says, look, I'm going to try, this could kill you, okay? This melanoma on your forehead can kill you. I'm going to try and get the right one, and I'm going to try to get it all out? Or would you go to the doctor that says, the dermatologist that says, Jim, we're going to get everything out. We're going to keep going until we get to the root of this thing and it's gone.
Yeah, of course, I want the positive, well-intended guy. So let me ask about the inner critic. You say believe the inner critic. My inner critic's pretty damn mean.
Yeah.
And you want me to believe that guy? I'll never go out again, especially with this new divot in my forehead.
That's right. You don't want to believe the inner critic. So, you know, say you
do or don't.
You do not want to listen to your inner critic ever.
Okay, good.
You want to just
like
shut
my
that
inner
guy.
Critic. He's a jerk.
Oh, it's terrible. And you know what? You feed it when you say, like, think of something that you've been trying to do. And then the inner critic says, you know what? You're just too lazy. You're not good enough for that. You're never going to do that. That's what happens when we kind of half-heart something and we're not really doing it all the way. And then we just give up. And then that's when the inner critic comes in and says, yeah, you're just too lazy. You've been trying so hard at this. It's never going to happen for you. And that's a collateral damage. That's like a side effect of trying. But when you do something and you either make it happen or not, and you know you've given it everything, your inner critic is silenced. It's like, baloney, you be quiet. I'm not weak. I'm not lazy. I'm not, I'm not that person that you're telling me, because I know what I did. I know everything I did to make this happen, and I feel confident. I feel like I have good self-esteem. I feel great about myself. When you do, that's what you feel.
Very well said. Very well said. Yeah, this is random, a random thing I've just discovered. I don't know why this is happening, but I don't even know why I'm mentioning it. But on your book on Amazon, most of the other books that Amazon suggests are Japanese business books.
No way. I haven't seen that. Wow.
Over half of them on the screen right now are Japanese business books.
Okay, that's really weird. Maybe I'm becoming big in Japan. I don't know.
I don't know either, but that's... anyway. All right. Dish us some dirt. Who's the biggest jerk you've ever worked with? No, I don't want to ask that.
Tell us how
you got so big in Hollywood. How did you create that career? Tell us about that.
Oh my gosh, this is a fun story. So, you know what? I worked for the Department of Defense as a young girl. I was in top secret security clearance for Northrop. And then I was too scared. I was helicoptered into secret locations and I was like not with the human beings. And I worked for an aviation company in employee relations. And I was loving that career. It was a company called...
Northrop is the center of the dark state, the deep state.
Yeah.
It is.
Yep. And I was helicoptered in. I was at secret
locations. I'm writing
a
book on that, on the deep state. Yes, I am. That's my next book. I will announce it now here. My next book is on the dark state.
I'm so excited. I'm so excited. Yeah, it's a thing.
Tell me about the dark state. I mean,
well, you know, there's an amazing scientists, and I saw them building the bombs. You know, like I saw it all going on, and it is deep, and I really can't talk about it. You know, I had a what do you call it, debriefing.
Uh-huh.
It was a long time ago, but you know, I got out. It was exciting, but I just was walking behind four doors that locked behind me and shredding bubblegum wrappers, you know, because for fear of any secrets getting out, it was just too dark for me. And I'm a people person. So anyway, I jumped from that into another job. And then by accident, I was dating a guy who was writing songs. And I met someone who had a song on the radio. And I'm like, oh, I can get my friend's song on the radio. So I started a publishing company. I just advertised for songs. And I took publishers out to lunch. And I'm like, how do you do what you do? How can I do that? And then I got a job as a secretary for a publisher in Hollywood. And I learned. I typed up contracts. I built my contact list. And I learned about pitching songs to artists, because that's what I wanted to do. I got my friend's song recorded. It was a big hit in Italy and in like four other languages. And then I just kept going. And I got hired by Chrysalis Music and then another company and another company. And finally, my end of my career. I was with EMI for many years. And I gave Christina Aguilera Genie in a Bottle. I put the two writers together that wrote it. And I was like, it was a very fun, creative environment. And I discovered my husband, who his name is John Ondrasik, and he performs under the moniker Five for Fighting. You might know his music, 100 Years, Superman. He's still touring. It's a pretty big deal. But I heard his voice through a wall, and I'm like, that voice needs to be on the radio. So I signed him, developed him, got him a record deal. Then I married him.
Wow, what a deal that was.
It's a great, great story. He's an amazing human being, beautiful music. It'll be around for a long time. And so I've had so much fun. And then I raised my kids, and then I've worked on this book for the last 20 years. I just love inspiring people. And I employed all of these tricks of not trying and doing in the music business. I have fun stories.
Tell us a story, but not who it's about.
I can just tell you a fun story about how I got a song on Cher's record, which is kind of fun.
Well, let me ask you this. I'm confused. You're acting like the song exists before the artist. Is that true? You're still like shopping
true.
Around a song. Okay.
I thought,
Taylor Swift writes her own songs, right? So no one's shopping her any songs, right? So
correct. But she does collaborate. So as a publisher, you could pitch your songwriters to write with her. The gold is getting a song on an album. And when I was doing it, you know, albums were selling millions and millions of copies and airplay. And, you know, you want it. So I represented songwriters and they would bring me songs. I also had huge back catalog of millions of titles of existing songs that, you know, you could take a Beatles cover and give it to Lady Gaga. Like, you want to make money on the songs. So I had a staff of writers that would bring me new stuff all the time, and they all wanted to be on the top records. And this one song came in called Heart of Stone, and I just knew it was a hit. And I asked my boss, I'm like, give me 24 hours exclusive. I don't want anyone else to pitch the song but me, and I'll get you a hit. And he said, okay, go. And I called Geffen Records. They had Aerosmith, Guns N' Roses. I mean, they had amazing artists at the time. And I called this guy, John Kolodner. He was an artist and repertoire representative, and he was very, very famous himself. And I called and I said, I want to bring the song over. It's a hit for somebody on your label. And the secretary was like, he doesn't meet with people. He doesn't do that. You're going to have to find another way to get your songs to the company. And I said to her, tell him that I'm coming over right now, that I'm bringing the song. I did it. I just was like, I'm not. I can't. That's it. I'm just coming over. I'm doing this. And when I got there, the door was wide open. I don't think he was so interested in hearing my song as much as meeting this crazy girl. Like, who is this girl? And he said, what have you got? And it was a cassette, and he popped it in, and he said, you're right. This is a hit. I'm going to figure out who we're giving it to. And it was the title track to Cher's biggest, like, international selling album. She is one of the top female recording artists of all time. Not a lot of people know that. And it was the album cover art, and they made a big music video out of it. But that's kind of the fun stuff there. I don't have a lot of negative stuff. You know, there were times when I thought I was going to be on an album, and then they drop your song, and that's always kind of a bummer. But you do your best. I would march songs into the studio where Michael Jackson was recording. You know, I was like, I got to get my song heard. So I would find out, where is he, like a detective, and bring the songs there. And, you know, nothing made it on an album, but I did everything I could. I'll tell you that. My writers were well represented.
Very cool. That is neat. I love that.
It's fun.
I never knew that about that industry. I heard, Carla, that you were willing to play our game, The Quick 10.
Yeah.
I have to ask, by state law, are you currently sober?
Currently sober, high on coffee.
All right. Do you want to accept the standard wager?
Yeah.
There you go. Number one, your favorite creativity hack?
Probably asking. My favorite creativity hack. Okay. Going for a swim and being out in nature. That just inspires me to no end. When I'm swimming in the pool, my brain just starts going, and when I'm taking a hike.
Number two, favorite bootstrapping trick.
Bootstrapping. Speaking engagements are amazing. Like talking to people and asking unabashedly what you need, you know, that'll drive needs. So speaking.
Number three, name your top passions.
Family, the animal kingdom, being out in nature, cooking, not necessarily eating, but cooking, and eliminating this nasty word try.
Number four, the first three steps in starting a business are?
Well, first of all, you have to have your need and an idea. Number two, starting a business, you have to believe and act already as if it's successful. And number three, be creative. Oh, you know, you have to find a back door to reach people, and you find your unique way. So starting a business, you have to find something that's a creative and unique way to get in.
Number five, the best way to get your first real customer is?
Relate to them on their level. Find something in common.
Number six, your dreamiest technology is?
Massaging driver seats in the car.
Number seven, best entrepreneurial advice?
One foot in front of the other. Start slowly.
Number eight, worst entrepreneurial mistake?
Starting too big, too fast.
Number nine, favorite entrepreneur and why?
Oh, I love Jason Pfeiffer. He's the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. He is so relatable and genuine and funny, and I absolutely adore following him. I've learned so much from Jason Pfeiffer.
He's been on the show here, and I argued with him about it's actually EMI. Oh, gosh. Number 10, favorite superhero?
Iron Man, because he's an inventor. I love Iron Man.
Great answers. Yes, EMI has sued me, I just remembered. Excellent answers,
no.
Carla. How do we find out more about you, get in touch, and all of that? And we'll find out the score in a minute. We have our judging staff working right now.
Oh, my gosh, can't wait. Okay, so you can find me. My website is stop-trying.com. Stop-trying.com. Follow me on Instagram at Carla Ondrasik, because I give really fun hits every day to remind us to be aware of what trying is and does and how it hurts us. And buy my book anywhere. It's, you know, on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and anywhere books are sold.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm still just kind of, wow. Oh, I just got your score, Carla. I'm so sorry. You got a 94. It's an excellent score, but you have to have a 95 to win this game. And so you owe us a Tesla. Thank you.
Okay. You got it.
Excellent. Carla, thank you so much. I hope the book sells well, and we'd love to have you back. We'll try to have you back.
With you. Don't you dare. I'm coming back. I'm going to show up in your studio. I'll be there. You better be ready.
Oh, we will be right back.
Okay. Goodbye.
We are back. And again, thank you so very much for being with us. Very excited to introduce another great guest. Please welcome Daniel Murray to the show. He is from Australia, and he is the author of The Empathy Gap. He is a very well-known speaker, trainer, and consultant, and focuses on blending behavioral science with emotional intelligence and leadership strategy. Daniel, welcome. How are you doing today?
I'm very good. Very good. Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure.
What is empathy, and how is it different from sympathy?
Yeah, so that definition gets, I get asked that question a lot. I think sympathy is pretty simply in my mind, what emotions I feel about your situation. So it's often a response that I have to observing or seeing someone else, and it's really about my feelings about that situation. Whereas when we think about empathy, we want to think about understanding what's going on for someone else. So it's really not about me. It's about the other person. It's about understanding what's going on for them. Why are they doing what they're doing? What's driving them? Sometimes those things are emotional. Sometimes they're logical and rational. Sometimes, and most of the time, they're a combination, I guess, of those two things. But it's really about trying to put myself into another person's world and understand what's driving them.
All right. I want to tell a story to make my point, and then I'll ask a question. So I had an employee, and we had a two-story office with a huge two-story area in the middle and offices upstairs around, and I was upstairs. And when I came out of my office, this one employee was directly sort of beneath me right there. And at the same time, I also was suffering from some walking and balance issues. And so I could only walk if I like stared straight down, and I had to watch my feet and, you know, use my hands to balance myself and stuff like that. And one day the CFO came to me and said, the comptroller, the guy who sits directly below me, has just quit. And I was like, oh, that's, I really liked him. And we didn't understand why he quit. I ran into him 3 or 4 years later at the mall. And I was like, why did you quit? I liked you. And we were so excited for you. He was like, he said, you were always staring at me. And I was like, what are you talking about? I was never staring at you. I don't know. What are you talking about? And he's like, every time you came out of your office, you were looking straight down at me. And I was like, no, I was looking at my feet so I didn't fall on you. So Daniel, how do I put myself into someone else's world when I can't even deal with that situation?
Yeah, the challenge that you're facing there and the other person was facing is that our the way we interact with the world is through assumptions and observations and creating patterns, and we do this very rapidly, very naturally. So I often say to people, if you walk into a room and someone's crossed their arms, someone at the table maybe has their arms crossed, as this person had done, it's easy for me to see that person with their arms crossed and then make an assumption as to what's going on. Then maybe they don't like me. Maybe I didn't write regards on that email. Maybe there's I stole their cookie or something, right? But the reality is, your assumption might be useful. It might be interesting. It might be based in your experience, but it doesn't mean that it's right. And as this person did about you, they use that assumption to make pretty significant decisions, and it was a really incorrect assumption. And so this is why I think at the heart of empathy is what we call being consciously curious. So acknowledging that, of course, we have assumptions, of course, we have biases and beliefs, and we have those things inbuilt, and we continually make new assumptions. All those things are lovely, but it doesn't mean that they're accurate. And we too often just search for validation for assumptions rather than being really curious to understand what's really going on. And again, if that person had come to you and said, hey, is everything okay? I've noticed you staring at me quite a bit. Are you all right? Like, what's going on? And you would have said, oh, yeah, I've got this thing going where I can't walk unless I look at my feet. Then the whole problem could have been solved. But we rely too much on those assumptions. And that's what I really want to make sure that we're trying to close, that gap between what we think is true and what's actually happening in the real world.
Okay, but I'm not allowed to ask you 610 things. You know, here in America, there's so many things I'm not allowed to ask. And so how do I find out what's really going on when I'm not allowed to ask what's really going on?
And again, this is where I think there's probably a few things at play. When you say not allowed to ask, I'm sure you've got friends. I know I've got friends who could ask me just about anything they wanted. Like, there would be no topics that would be off limits. And then, of course, there are other people who would be less likely to ask certain questions. And that comes down to things like relationship trust. So when I work in teams, a lot of the thing that I focus on is, what is the trust between the relationships that allows us to have those conversations and ask those questions? And in the absence of having that relationship trust, what we tend to do is just use our pre-existing beliefs and biases, which aren't always that generous. So I think one thing I would say to people is the people who you do have a good relationship or need to have a good relationship with, then I would encourage you to build that trust so you can ask the questions. And doing that is about asking questions in a generous way. You say there's things that you can't ask or you shouldn't ask. But if a young child asked you some of those questions, you'd probably give them some grace and allow them to ask that question because they're coming at it with good faith. And I think if we treat each other with good faith and with that sort of generosity, it's okay. And the second portion, though, is if I can't or I don't think I can ask you that question, I'm unsure, then what's my residual baseline? What's left? And I always say to people, a really good principle to hold on to is assume good intent. Assume that the person is doing something not because they're malicious or angry or upset or some sort of horrible bias that I've got. Assume they're doing it from a benign or relatively sort of neutral position, or if not from a good position. And again, if I see someone walking along staring at the ground, I get to make an assumption. I get to choose from a million different things that could be going on. And I would say it's pretty self-centered to say, well, it must be all about me. That's why they're looking down. So I think we have to take ownership for that control and that that basis for our assumptions, a starting place. And if we all assume good intent of each other, yeah, we might be wrong sometimes. But in my experience, actually, most people are just trying their best, and it's not a bad place to start.
Ooh, I don't know. I'm just afraid America is just so litigious right now. And, you know, I've been sued, you know, and too many of us owners have been sued for crazy stuff. And, you know, it seems, I don't know. Right now, I have to say I'm moving away from wanting to know a single thing about an employee because you're just setting yourself up for trouble, you know? And I think that if that standard might be almost a legal requirement now.
Well, maybe. I think I'm going to controversial and say that I think that's a really sad position if we get there. I think
it's sad, but do you not think that's where America is?
I don't know that is the universal experience. And again, I think this is where each of us have a responsibility to shape the culture around us. You know, people talk a lot about culture and we get fascinated by culture surveys and reports and you know, answering a whole bunch of questions. And none of those things are what culture really is. Culture is the subjective experience, subconscious experience that I'm having in the environment around me. And while a lot of that is shaped by everything else around me, I play a role in that. And I think it's important that all of us have the conversations and the responsibility to say, well, what's the intent going on? You know, what's the moral basis for why we're doing what we're doing? And I think the challenge will be if we all disconnect because it's too scary and concerning to have a connection and a real relationship with people around us, I think we'll be at a disadvantage to the organizations in particular that can build that real sense of connection, can build a culture of trust and it can work together more effectively. I have a, you know, the basis of evolutionary biology gives me comfort that the improved performance of those sorts of groups that do have those sorts of abilities will outperform.
In your book, you have a process to work towards this. You have the empathy process. Mm-hmm. Can you walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something, you know, I had a degree in mathematics, spent a lot of time working in business strategy and financial services and a very analytical brain. And when I thought about empathy, I wanted to be able to practice this like in a methodical and sort of pragmatic way. So I couldn't find a process when I went searching, and I built this one. And the first portion of it, the first step, is to be what I call consciously curious. And this is really that process of saying, I do have assumptions and beliefs and biases and heuristics, but if I really want to understand another person, I'm going to try and park all of these things. And that's an easy thing to say and a hard thing to do. But it's a really important first step. And I'd say this with honesty, I don't think you should have empathy for everyone all the time. I think that's exhausting. I think it's unrealistic. And really what I want to do is think, if I really want to understand someone who's different to me, maybe the first step is to put aside all those beliefs I've got and just try and start with curiosity, conscious curiosity, a blank sheet of paper. And the reason why that's important is the second step is being openly to explore, so openly exploring. And if I'm not consciously curious, what I'll do is I'll search for validation. I'll search for information that validates these previous assumptions. And, you know, your country is no different to mine in this regard. We have millions and millions of people who do it the other way around, have an assumption, go searching on the internet or trying to find people who just validate their beliefs. They harden in those beliefs, and we dig trenches and throw rocks at each other. So we want to rebalance this by saying, hey, I don't know, I'm interested, just tell me some information, do this exploration. That's the second step. The third step is to then challenge your mental model. So you have a whole bunch of beliefs, good for you, they're your beliefs, but you can reshape and change and modify and adapt these at any stage in your life. And I would argue that the greatest superpower we have as humans is our ability to think, then rethink, then reshape and realign the way we see the world to new information and new facts, new data, new experiences we have. And once we've done this sort of change, then we can make new decisions. So leading with empathy, in my view, is making better decisions that are more aligned with our experience, with what's going around us, with the complexity and nuance of the world, and making decisions that better serve us, the world around us, and create a better society. And I think this is a really so critical for every part of the world right now to have this ability to be flexible in our thinking, to see each other not from a position of colors and borders and all of these other things that we fascinate on, but to see that we're all humans and we're making decisions and we have to be able to work out what's going on in each other's world a bit more effectively before we just assume that we're the good guys and everyone else is the bad guys and we sort of push a button that creates some havoc for everyone.
All right, so how do we properly ask someone, an employee, what's going on? How can I help you? Can I be nice to you? How do we do that properly?
Yeah, this is where we have to remember that interactions between humans aren't transactions. Right, having this conversation, people often ask me, particularly when we talk about things like giving hard feedback, what's the script or what are the words you use? You know, I really dislike the sandwich, you know, the something nice, something bad, something nice. There's a whole bunch of work I do around that, but the premise I always give people is, listen, if the person doesn't trust you, it really doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't matter if it's Shakespearean in the way you deliver it. That basis of trust is going to be the thing that determines whether you can ask the question or not. And I'm sure, Jim, you've got friends who you could ask very directly in any way and it wouldn't matter, and they would answer you and they'd know you've come from a good place. And there'll be other people that you wouldn't ask any question because the level of trust isn't there to be able to do it. So what I would say to an employer, if you're working with employees, is think about this over time. This isn't a one-off transaction. There's no button you can press. I can't flick a switch, or you can't say a magical phrase. You're not Harry Potter, right? This is something that's going to take time. And the first thing you have to be is to genuinely care about that person. And I don't mean be concerned about them for your own purposes. I mean, actually, you really are interested in that person. And showing that genuine care and starting to have that conversation and build that trust over time means that through that process, you'll have a relationship where you can say, hey, Jim, are you okay? What's going on? I've noticed your numbers are down, or you're coming in late, or this is what's happening. I'm worried about you. What's up? And that, you know, people want that. They want the ability to have that conversation, but they don't want to do the work over time to show that they really care. And my honest opinion here is I don't know if this is your experience here, but a lot of people tell me I'm too busy to do that. I'm too busy doing work to have that sort of relationship or invest that time. And sometimes they'll say, look, what if I don't care about them? What if I don't really care about them as people? And my honest answer is, if you're too busy or you don't care, then you're not a leader, and stop leading that person, because we need leaders around us who are willing to actually care. Leadership is not paint by numbers. It's not a transaction. It's about actually, you know, caring about that person enough that you want to help them, you want to support them, you want better for them, and therefore interact with them over time, build this sense of trust, and then I'll have the ability to ask the questions and build that relationship and have that foundation to have those tougher conversations later on.
All right. What happens when the robots start to cry?
Yeah, it's a fascinating world, isn't it?
That's a chapter out of your book, so I'm not just pulling this out of thin air. What happens when robots cry, Daniel?
It's an interesting one, and I guess my first question would be, if one of your people cry, if you're an employee or you're a customer, if they cry, why do they do that? And, you know, you'll probably say, I guess they're sad, or, you know, we don't really understand why people do what they do. The robots piece is a really interesting one, because I don't know if you found this. I'm interested in your thoughts here. When I first heard about how a large language model makes decisions, you know, that it just basically looks at these patterns of words and picks the next best word based on sort of mathematics and this process, the first thing I thought was, geez, is that how I do it? Like, how do I choose the next word? I don't think 50 words ahead and have all this planned out. You know, what we don't really know yet, I guess, is whether robots will have consciousness, whether they'll have emotional feelings and those sorts of pieces. But I think we have to start getting prepared for a world where we have to manage non-human decision-making entities. And maybe they'll get sad, maybe they won't. I think it's more dangerous, to be honest, if they don't cry. When you ask a human to do something and you maybe haven't foreseen all of the possible outcomes that will take place. You might have sort of thought, I'm going to ask this robot to do this thing and I'm sure it'll work out fine. If I ask a person to do this process and I think it's going to work out fine, but they encounter something that's morally disturbing, hopefully that person will ring the bell for us and go, hey, boss, I know you asked me to do this, but this doesn't feel right. And hopefully that process of them saying that, or enough people saying that, will allow us to maybe check in, course correct, and make it a little bit better in terms of the way we do things. What I'm seeing and what we've experienced through a number of different algorithms already is that the robots don't do that. They dutifully continue regardless of the outcome, because they aren't really asked to take on any of that emotional feedback. And they will dutifully carry out tasks forever and ever. And I think that's a really concerning thing. So my other challenge back to you would be, should we make robots so they can cry? Should we make algorithms that can feel emotions and then act upon that emotional feedback loop process? I don't know. What do you think? Is it something we need to be able to do as we move forward?
I don't know. The whole point of having a robot is so you don't have to deal with all of those emotional issues and stuff. So seriously, if that's part of the program, I don't want it. You know, vote out. And so, you know, because then they could just start killing you too. You know, that's, you just made it even scarier for me, Daniel.
Well, I don't know. Maybe so can the people. The people could start killing you. You know, I think this is something
that that's already baked really into life. There's no reason to bring in more things that could kill us.
Well, hopefully the robots are going to be more controllable because they're a little bit more predictable than the randomness of people. You know, often people say to me, I wouldn't want a plane to be an AI or a pilot to be an AI or a doctor. I wouldn't want a doctor to be a robot. And you know, when you think about it, I'd actually prefer something that could capture far more data and make much more complex decisions based on infinitely more data than a human. To me, that's actually probably a good thing rather than relying on the fallibility of humans. But you raise a good point because it comes back to that word trust again. You know, when I say who would make this decision for me, or when you say, oh, what if they're going to try and kill me? It comes back to, well, do I trust this person or this entity or this decision-making AI? Do I trust it? And we're going to have to try and bake in these processes to help people to build that sense of trust. And again, this comes back to understanding humans and why do we do what they do? Why do you worry about that? Why does that create anxiety for you? And then how can we redesign the system to make it better for you?
So would you get in an airplane that had AI only pilots, no humans in the front?
Personally, sure. I guess a better way of asking the question is, what things could a human do that an AI agent or some sort of robot couldn't do? And do you think that it would be easier to train a human to deal with the exceptions than to train a robot to deal with those exceptions? You know, humans have this beautiful overconfidence bias. I think it was a study out of the US where they asked humans or people, you know, are you a better than average driver? You know, and 88% of people said they were better than average, which is, as a mathematician, really hurts me, right? That's statistically impossible. I think you'd find that that overconfidence bias is something that we should be careful of. You know, I'm very cautious of people who say they know everything or have all the answers or have never got anything wrong or are the best at certain things when, you know, statistically it's unlikely that's true. And I'd like to think that potentially the robots have less ego than we do, so maybe that'll be a good thing.
We don't know that. Maybe they're not. Daniel, we need to wrap it up. How do we get in touch, find out more, and learn to have more empathy with you?
Yeah, look, you can get in touch with me through my website, danielmurray.au, over here in Australia. And I'm always interested in having conversations. I'll be over in the US later in October, and I'm really looking forward to working over there with some good companies. So, jump in onto my website, connect with me on LinkedIn, send me a carrier pigeon if you need to. Any way we can get in touch, I'm always looking forward to connecting with new people.
Thank you so much for being with us. Great information, and I will try to have more empathy, especially for the robots.
Good luck, Jim.
We are out of time for today, but you know what we do. That's right. We come back tomorrow. Be safe, take care, and go make $1 million by now.